We announced in the last episode of the Old Frontline podcast that season 5 had come to an end, and so it has. But what I thought I'd do, and probably this kind of approach is a little bit overdue with the podcast, is that I'd kind of have a bit of a season roundup, really, just to talk about what we've done and what we've covered. And then also use it as an opportunity to look ahead. And as usual, we can't just talk about what the podcast is, but we'll have a couple of little stories about those battlefields in this episode as well. So it's a much shorter episode than usual, but just a neat way, I hope, to kind of round off what we've done in this season. And we may well do it again for the next season. So as Season 5 does come to an end, we've had 8 months, believe it or not, of podcasts. This season started in January and it's finished now in the summer, 24 episodes. And we've covered quite a lot of diverse subjects. Now, a lot of people ask me, how do I really produce this podcast, I guess, is what they're actually asking. Do I have this kind of great plan and I plan out the whole season episode by episode? I kind of wish possibly that I did, but that isn't the approach that I have. I come up with some ideas and I've got better at kind of formulating these now. I'm standing here now with my notebook next to me and I kind of write down program episode ideas in that and then add a few little questions and comments and so on. Really, I don't kind of list the whole season. And things come up, of course. I see things in social media, read something in a book, or watch something on YouTube. Or more commonly, I go out to the battlefields themselves. And that gives me a lot of kind of thinking space, really, as to what we might talk about in a future episode of The Old Front Line. And although often I'm out there on tours when I'm working, I do find that a good time to really formulate some ideas and some direction in terms of the episodes that we have. So although I might not go somewhere to record anything, I visit somewhere, go into a museum, walk through an area of preserved trenches, see some graves in a cemetery, and it kind of provokes some ideas. So there's a lot of thinking time really goes into this podcast, to produce this podcast. And then I kind of formulate those thoughts and then put them into episode ideas. And it's kind of an organic thing, I think, really. Although I have some definitive ideas about what it is I want to talk about in that season, it can change. Sometimes I kind of run out of time to do as much of the background research that I need. And I do research for all of the episodes that we produce. We're often visiting and talking and walking across ground that I've visited many times, but I go back to see kind of what the latest information is on a cemetery or memorial and want to add that to it so that you can get as much as possible from that particular episode. And I'm lucky I'm surrounded now by my library of Great War books, from memoirs to official histories to regimental and divisional histories. And then a lot of more recent publications, and not just in English. I've got books here in German and French. And I'm sure, like many of you listening to this podcast, I'm an avid book buyer. And they often throw up new ideas as well. New books get published, new memoirs are put into print. And that takes you down a kind of rabbit hole, if you like, or certainly a communication trench to take you to an idea that might feature in a podcast. And then when I've got an episode idea together, what I do, none of these are ever scripted. There's no script. It's just me talking into the microphone. When I did the very early episodes of The Old Front Line, I just kind of switched it on and spoke in the same kind of way I would do on a battlefield tour with a microphone in my hand on a coach. But I found myself going off in all kinds of different curves and angles. And what I've done in the last few seasons for each episode is formulate a running order, if you like, where I kind of list the topics that I want to talk about. I note down any particular detailed information that we need for the podcast. I can keep a lot in my head. I'm lucky like that. But I don't necessarily keep the exact composition of burials for all 2,000 plus British and Commonwealth cemeteries on the Western Front, for example. So, and I want the details to be correct when we do the podcast. So I look those up and put those on the running order as well. But what's in this running order generally is just a list of subjects or places that we're going to go to, and then there'll be a question in there where it will say discuss or talk about this in depth, and that's when I just kind of turn on the microphone and start talking and kind of see where that conversation goes. So, you know, I mean, thank you for all the incredibly kind reactions that I get to the podcast. So what I'm hoping is that that kind of works, really. So when I go back over season 5 and I look at those episodes that we've done covering quite a lot of diverse subjects, there were a few in there that I'd had kind of boiling away in the background in my head for quite some time. And there are two episodes in this season that were particular favourites of mine that I wanted to do and gave me great pleasure in doing them, and hopefully did the same for you. And one of those was The Art of War, which is what kicked season 5 off back in January, where, and it's an interesting kind of concept for a podcast, which is an audio product. There's no visuals when you're listening to this. You're in your headphones, in your front room, in your car, you know, wherever it is you listen. So to talk about art, to talk about paintings in a podcast is quite a potentially challenging thing to do. But I think it kind of worked by putting the images onto the podcast website and also talking about what those works of art meant. And I'm not an art historian or an expert or any of that kind of stuff in terms of the art itself. What interests me is the depiction of the Great War, the depiction of that Great War landscape and what it tells us about the landscape of the past and how we link that to the landscape of the future. And that was quite a popular episode, and I'm sure it is something we will return to with some other war artists down the line. The other one, of course, and I say of course, but was Birds on the Western Front, where we looked at the use of birds in the Great War with carrier pigeons, for example, but also what the soldiers saw from their trenches, the bird watchers of the Great War, seeing those birds on the wire, watching the migration of birds at the two bookends of the year, and what's that meant to them, just as what it means to us today. And where we often talk about the layers of the Great War, and there are many of them, and I think that going to the battlefields, visiting the cemeteries, understanding what happened there in terms of the history is probably several of those layers. But there are other layers too, just as the men who were there more than a century ago experienced as well. And nature and the bird life on the battlefields is certainly one of them. It is no accident that this podcast is introduced by the sound of the skylark, because for me, and that within me prompted by what I remember hearing from Great War veterans who in particular had served on the Somme, and how that they could remember hearing the sound of the skylark in that momentary pause between the end of the barrage, the preliminary barrage on the Somme, and the whistles blowing to signal going over the top at 0 hour on the 1st of July 1916. They remembered hearing that skylark and how it transported them back to that moment, that brief moment of respite before the world changed forever. And I think that having grown up in the Sussex landscape, which is a rolling chalk downland, and then spent a lot of my time visiting and then living on the Somme, which is another chalk landscape, seeing the kind of birds in Britain and then seeing similar birds on that landscape of the Somme in France, I think that is definitely for me another connection. And I know many of you who listen to this, you feel the same way. And I hope that that episode perhaps prompted that in many of you who've never really thought about that before. You know, during COVID, nature suddenly was really important to people when they were locked inside, and the importance of a connection to the natural world was suddenly important. And I think we can do that as well on the battlefields. It's not just about bombs, bullets and bayonets. It's about so much more. And I'm really glad to have had that opportunity to do an episode on birds on the Western Front. And I'm sure, like so many of these things, it could be something that we return to again. The other thing I've tried to bring into this season as well is a lot more of other military forces apart from Britain and the Commonwealth. So we've had a dip into the history of the American Expeditionary Force with, for example, the Doughboys in Flanders episode, where we looked at the American units that fought alongside the British in that summer of 1918, and then other units that were sent up to fight alongside them in the final advance through Belgium leading up to the last battles of the Great War in November 1918. As ever, I've wanted to really promote the importance of our understanding of the French participation in the Great War. We've had a couple of visits to Verdun in this season with a trench of bayonets and Verdun in a day. And that's really important to get beyond the Somme, as I often say, get beyond those Somme battlefields of 1916, down into what is the rest of the Western Front, this vast area that was occupied by French troops facing the German army. Other units from many other nations fought alongside them at different points in the war, from men within their own colonies who fought there. There were Russians, there were Czech volunteers, there were Polish volunteers, there were British and American volunteers in the French Foreign Legion fighting in those areas. And then in the latter part of the war, that's where the bulk of the American Expeditionary Force, the AEF, fought in those final battles of 1918. So that's something that the podcast obviously will continue to do, is to talk not just about the British side of the Great War, not just about the Somme, but the Somme will always draw us back, of course, but to tell those other stories as well, and that's really important. The other thing in this series I've been able to do is some better outside broadcast episodes. I had some equipment fail. There's no getting around that. We had some equipment fail in some of the earlier attempts at doing that. But thanks to those of you who support the podcast by Buy Me a Coffee and Patreon, I've used some of that to invest in kit. And I've got some really good wireless microphones that I've used for a few episodes now, where I've walked the ground talking into one of these microphones and the sound level has been good, and I've learned some lessons from that and perfected that, and that's something that will continue for future episodes. I found as well that by even going back to places which we've discussed from afar in the podcast, where I've kind of done a virtual walk in my head and explained that walk to you through the podcast, going back there to walk that ground again, actually being there, gives a slightly different dimension to it. And I'm sure that we'll return to quite a few places that we've visited virtually in previous seasons. It's also enabled me to do a few interviews on site as well, having this kit to travel as I did to Belgium with my old pal John Hayes Fisher, to meet up with the Royal Sukkou and have our forgotten battlefield reunion, where the three of us sat down in Nick's excellent little cottage there at Hoog, right on the old front line, to discuss that filming that we did of that big archaeological project from all those years ago. Was a really good use of the technology, and I think again brought a different kind of level to the normal chats that we have, which are often done remotely. And the recent recording that I made with Beverly Palin, where we recorded her playing those World War One period instruments, Wilfred the melodeon and Reg the trench organ, and speaking about the music of the Great War, I think again that using that kit, it enabled me to do that in a slightly different way. So we'll continue to do that, and I hope in the coming year to get out on the battlefields and meet up with some people and do some more recordings on those battlefields with people who've got an interesting story to tell. The most popular episodes of this season, perhaps unsurprisingly, have been the first day on the Somme, where we walked the whole front line from Gommecourt down to Montauban. That had a staggering number of views and put it into the top 10 of all of the episodes of the podcast since we started three and a half years ago now. Also, the Hindenburg line, which is an interesting one, why that was so popular. I think a lot of people don't know as much about the Hindenburg line battlefields as they do the Somme or up in Flanders. And that had a lot of interest to podcast listeners and was reflected in the downloads and the Verdun episodes again as well. And I think it shows that this is not a British battlefield of the Great War, but interest in understanding and learning more about Verdun is, I think, continues to be on a big scale. And that's good news because it's part of our wider understanding of what the whole war was about. And the trench chats that we've had this season, it's not a traditional podcast, this, in so many ways probably, but it's not just about me talking to somebody. I think those kind of podcasts can really quickly become parodies of themselves in some ways. But having guests on to talk about the research they've done on the books that they've written is really important. And I think we've had some really interesting ones this season. Professor Mark Connolly talking about his work on the aftermath of the Great War. I could listen to Mark all day long talk about that. He's a very engaging speaker, and he is definitely someone who I hope will be returning for season 6. Roger Stewart, who lives in Ypres, who's written those two fantastic books about Langemark, German Cemetery, and then Reclaiming the Ypres Salient. That was a very popular episode, and I'm pleased to hear about so many of you who went on to buy Roger's book. It's always really important to support authors like this, and his book is an excellent Great War publication. And as I said during the chat with him, it's not often that you can say this is genuinely new information, not just the same old stories trotted out. This is genuinely new information, and it's a fantastic book. And if you've not yet listened to that episode or picked up Roger's book, I can thoroughly recommend that. A book that's coming up, we heard about with the discussion with Caitlin DeAngelis, with that book about the caretakers, the Imperial War Graves Commission gardeners who got caught up in the story of the next war in World War II, when the Germans overran northern France and cemeteries were now under German occupation, and some gardeners carried on their work and others got arrested and deported and many died. And I think that's part of a regular theme that we have there, which we'll come back to at the tail end of this podcast, is that connection, that weave of the story between World War I and World War II, where the first Great War meets the second Great War. Really important to understand. And next season we'll have a few more trench chats, and I hope to get some of the old friends of the podcast who were with us from the very beginning back on to talk about some of the work that they're doing now. And I think one episode that again spiked a lot of interest with people was a bit of a portent of the future, the changing nature of the landscape of the Western Front, with the episode on the Canal du Nord, which is that big engineering project that's going to see this massive super canal built right across the battlefields of 1917-18. And what we tried to do in that episode was talk about the importance of that ground, the history of that ground, and what might happen when this engineering project takes place, and how that might change that part of the landscape of the Great War. And again, I know that that is something that we will return to. It's very much in the thoughts of anyone who visits that part of the Great War battlefields. And of course, the War Graves Commission, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, are preparing for that with the extension to the Lewes British Cemetery and the possibility of finding hundreds of soldiers' remains when that canal is built. And I hope to speak to somebody from the Commission sometime soon about that work that's going to take place with the Canal du Nord, and about the work that they're doing at Lewes to ensure that space is there for soldiers who are found, and hopefully many of them identified too. Again, it reflects that other common statement that we make in this podcast all the time, that the last page of the history of the Great War will probably never be turned. And in terms of a few statistics, I'm not going to bombard you with the kind of download stats, but I'm very proud and very grateful that this season has had nearly 250,000 downloads. This season on its own, we're coming up to 1 million downloads in all, and nearly 250,000 of those are from season 5. The top countries that people come from who listen to the podcast, unsurprisingly, it's the United Kingdom, the United States, Australia, Canada, and the Netherlands. A very high number of our listeners are from the Netherlands, and that's really interesting as well. I think there's been a long-standing interest in the Great War in the Netherlands. Some of those very early websites in the early days of the internet were from Dutch visitors who came to the Western Front. And there's a very active Netherlands branch, almost a separate organisation of the Western Front Association, that publishes its own journal. So it's good to see that that is continuing, and that this kind of spirit of interest in the Great War in the Netherlands is not fading away. One other element of the podcast that I brought in this season was the first publication of a battlefield vlog, a video blog. essentially a small film where I filmed a walk that I did across Hawthorne Ridge and told the story of Eric Keaton at Hawthorne Ridge Number 1 Cemetery. That I filmed on my iPhone. I've upgraded some of the kit and I've got a 4K DJI camera that I use for that now. I need to also upgrade my Mac because 4K video uses up a lot of memory, and the poor old Mac that I've got, which is great for producing this podcast, can't cope with 4K films. So I've got probably at least a couple of films that I made up at Ypres on the Bellawada Ridge and at Hoog that I need to edit once I've upgraded my kit. And once I've done that, I shall be putting those onto the podcast YouTube channel. And if you've not had a chance to subscribe or even look at the Old Frontline YouTube channel, please do go on there. There's some of the old Periscope videos that I used to do through Twitter, filming myself talking about different parts of the Great War battlefields in France and Flanders. And then there's some more recent things on there and some shorts that I've done, portrait style videos similar to Instagram reels. And I've got quite a few of those on Instagram if you follow me on there, just talking about different parts of the battlefields, Douaumont, the Somme, Ypres, whatever it is. So if you've not looked at the YouTube channel, all you've got to do is look up Old Frontline. There's a link to it from the podcast website as well, oldfrontline.co.uk. And you can go on there and subscribe and do have a watch of a few things on there. Now, that's not going to replace the podcast. I've put some of the podcast episodes on there because YouTube in the coming year are really going to start promoting podcasts, and I want to have some of the popular episodes on there to feature in the possibility of a new audience perhaps listening to them through YouTube. But it does help if you go on there and kind of like and comment on things, and that'd be really great. But it's not going to replace what we do here because the podcast is very much at the kind of heart of what the Old Frontline is all about. I just hope that the YouTube side of it and some of these vlogs will add a slightly different dimension to it. And I've spoken about the upgrading of kit and so on, and that's all made possible by those of you who very kindly support this podcast financially via Buy Me a Coffee and Patreon. Now, everyone supports the podcast. This is always something I really want to kind of emphasize. Everyone supports the podcast just by listening to it, by downloading the podcast episodes. All of that helps us. But there are some very kind people who want to support creatives like me who produce material like this, and that is greatly appreciated. And we've got a lot of you who've done that through Buy Me a Coffee and through Patreon, and that has enabled me to upgrade the kit that I've got and get new material, fund trips over there and all that kind of stuff. So that is really, really appreciated. And I like to give something back. A lot of those people just in the early days just wanted to support what I was doing, but I like to give something back. So when you do support the podcast in that way, whether it's through a one-off via Buy Me a Coffee or on a regular basis through Patreon, what we do is we have a little podcast supporters community, and I send out a newsletter every month to all the podcast supporters where we have some stories from the battlefields and photographs and news and things like that. And then we have a supporters evening every month where we get on Zoom, and we've had a few guests on there talking about different aspects of the Great War. Recently we had David Blanchard, for example, talking about the battles on the Chemin des Dames in May 1918. Otherwise, I use it as an opportunity to share some original Great War images with the supporters, have a little chat about what these images are and what they tell us about the Great War. We've been having book clubs recently where people have come on, the supporters themselves, and spoken about what books they're reading and recommended those to others, and that's been really good as well. So when you do support the podcast in that way, you get a little bit of extra back. There's no kind of hidden episodes or anything like that. I'm not going to go down that route. And the podcast will always, always be free at the point of use. So that's a really important principle, a founding principle of this podcast, and something that will never change. It will always, always be free. And I kind of gladly do that because having spent all these decades walking these battlefields, researching these battlefields, speaking, as I was so lucky to do, with the veterans of the Great War, what's the point of kind of locking all of this away? It's important to tell these stories and share this information with a wider audience. And I'm so pleased to see other people do that as well, like Terry Wenham with his podcast and Matt Dixon and so many others. And do listen to theirs as well. It's really, really important to hear all these different voices. And I would hope and wish that more people will attempt to do some podcasts down the line. But just coming back to our supporters, like I say, if you do support the podcast in that way through Buy Me a Coffee or Patreon, there is a little kind of extra little bit, newsletter, podcast supporters evenings that you get back as well. But whatever you do, just by downloading, listening every week on a regular basis, all of that helps. And I'm so grateful for the huge amount of correspondence I get via email and comments on the website where people ask questions and they say how what a particular episode has meant to them. I just love that, and please, please do continue to do that. And leaving comments and reviews on Apple Podcasts, you can now leave little comments on Spotify as well. All of that helps the podcast as well. So thanks really to all of you in that respect. And long may this little community of people who are interested in the Great War, which we all are, that we've built up, long may that continue. It's a subject that none of us own, but we're passionate about. And listening to this podcast, I hope, is part of a kind of wider interest that you've all got, whether as members of the Western Front Association or the Great War Group, or whether you listen to other podcasts as well. It's really important to do all of these things, to continue our interest in this beyond the centenary, to ensure that what the veterans that I interviewed back in the 80s and 90s feared, that the Great War would disappear into history and never be remembered. We must actively ensure, I would hope, that that will never, ever happen. One thing that I spoke about quite a few times this year with some of you in person, when I've been lucky to meet some of you on the battlefields and through our Zoom meetings for the support, is the idea of a battlefield meetup where listeners to the Old Frontline podcast can get together on the actual Old Frontline itself. And I was hoping to do that this October, but I've got to move house fairly shortly. The Old Frontline is moving location, so that means I think this autumn is going to be very unlikely. So I'm looking now towards next March, April. I'm formulating some ideas. It will take place in Flanders, somewhere around Ypres. It will not involve an organised battlefield tour. It will be one or more days where we'll meet up there on the ground and we'll walk a bit of the ground and talk about our collective interest in the First World War and hopefully hear a few other voices apart from just me as well. So that's something that's in the planning stages, and details will be out on that further down the line, probably, I would guess, towards the kind of Christmas New Year period. So watch this space, as they say. And looking ahead to season 6, like I said earlier, when you know people ask how do you do this podcast, I haven't got a grand list as such at the moment for season 6, but I've already started scribbling down in the notebook some ideas of different episodes. You may have seen on Twitter recently, I've started rereading Charlie's War comics. That was a great inspiration to me in the 1980s, and there will be very early on in season 6, possibly even the first episode, you've heard it here first, that there will be one about Charlie's War. And I'm going to do another one about graphic novels as a whole, because I think it's an interesting genre, an interesting layer to the Great War, and an important one, just like Great War fiction, because this mostly is fiction. They're not following precise stories, not quite like the Victor comic exploits of Victoria Cross recipients used to see in, I think, every edition of the Victor. These are generally fictional stories of the First World War, and I think they add something to our understanding, and I think they're important to look at. So there will be something on Charlie's War, because that's got a special place for me, and there will be some wider discussions of graphic novels generally, including some from other countries. There's two in particular I want to discuss, several probably I want to discuss from other countries, but certainly some from France, and there's also a very early one, which is before graphic novels, I think, were even thought of, but this is a book that shows the experience of an Austro-Hungarian soldier in the Great War, so we'll talk about that as well. So that's a definite subject that we're going to look at in season 6. There'll be some more Battlefields in a Day episodes because they are proving very popular. And one of the early ones of those, we'll look at the Chemin des Dames Battlefields of 1917 in a day. And like I mentioned, some trench chats with some old friends of the podcast and some new friends of the podcast as well. So season six will return. Here we are coming towards the end of August. It will be back, the podcast, in September. Because of the house move, I don't know exactly when, but what I'm planning to do is to kind of bank a couple of episodes so we can get something out in September and then hopefully get back to normal in the kind of October period. So that's the plan. So there'll be a little bit of a gap now. You can go back through some of the episodes. I know a few of you are a few weeks behind, and that's absolutely fine, of course, but there'll be a little bit of a gap and you can go back. And if you've got a chance to kind of re-listen to some episodes, then please do, because it will probably refresh your memory about some subjects and might inspire you to do a bit of reading or even think about your next trip to the battlefields. So that's a kind of podcast roundup, overview, whatever we're going to call it, that I wanted to do. But we can't have an episode of The Old Front Line where we don't talk about some stories of the Great War. So that's what we'll do next. I'm lucky that my job is quite literally the battlefields, not just of the Great War, but of quite a few different conflicts, but in particular the First and the Second World War. My job as a battlefield guide, as the product manager, if you like, of Ledger Battlefields, means that I get out onto the battlefields on a regular basis to guide tours, to look at new things on the battlefields, to think about new itineraries that we might bring in. And that means that I get to kind of get out on the ground on a regular basis. And as I mentioned kind of earlier in this podcast, that often gives me some valuable thinking time as to what we might cover in some future episodes. And I think that's really important. I think that all of us probably find that when we visit the battlefields that it throws up even more questions, really. You know, we've probably answered a lot of questions by planning and going on a trip, but once you're there and you visit bits of ground and you look at the geography of the landscape and you read the inscriptions on headstones and you find unusual graves in the cemeteries, whatever it is, that will inspire new searches, new thoughts, new avenues for you to pursue. And I think that's one of the great pleasures of studying something like this. And earlier this year, I was on a battlefield tour and we went to Bennysomer Canadian War Cemetery. Now that's a Second World War cemetery that overlooks Juno Beach, where the Canadians landed on D-Day, the 6th of June 1944. It's one of two main Canadian cemeteries in Normandy. The second one at Bretteville-sur-Laize is on the route to Falaise, where the breakout battles were fought in the summer of 1944. And these two cemeteries kind of reflect those two different periods of the Normandy campaign from the Canadian perspective. Bennysomer, with the men killed in the landings on D-Day, through to the battles around Caen and the beginning of the breakout, and then Bretteville, the route to Falaise and the breakout from Normandy itself. And I went there for a special visit for somebody who wanted to visit the grave of a relative. And I wandered around and made my way. There's a couple of graves I always go and look at in there for a number of reasons. But one I went to, as I hadn't seen it for a while, was the grave of Captain Stephen Stanley Bird. He was an officer in the North Nova Scotia Highlanders and was killed in action on the 8th of July 1944, aged 24. That was in the fighting around Caen. He was the son, and this is where the kind of connection comes in, he was the son of William R. and Ethel Bird of Halifax. William Bird, his father, was Will Bird, one of the greatest Canadian authors of the 20th century and one of the most important writers on the subject of the Great War, at least in my opinion. Will Bird was born in Canada in 1891, so he was Canadian born. When you think that so many men who served with the Canadian Expeditionary Force in the Great War were born in Britain or in other countries, Will Bird was a Canadian, and he joined the 42nd Battalion Canadian Infantry, the Black Watch of Canada, and he served with them from the tail end of the Somme through the operations in 1917, from Vimy to Hill 70 to Passchendaele, and then in the final battles of 1918. When he was in a trench on the Somme, he found a piece of Roman archaeology, a Roman warrior's sword, and that, I think, is in the Museum of the Black Watch of Canada, preserved. He was also awarded the Military Medal for his bravery in the fighting, the last Canadian fighting of the Great War at Mons in November of 1918. So a fascinating individual, a really interesting war, an unusual war, and a war in which he showed great bravery, being awarded the Military Medal in those final actions of Canada's parts in that conflict. He went on to write a number of books about his Great War experience. The most famous title, which probably most of you will know, is Ghosts Have Warm Hands, which was originally published as And We Go On. And it was out of print for many, many years, and the Canadian historian Norm Christie republished it in a paperback version under that title, Ghosts Have Warm Hands. And it refers to his brother Stephen, who had enlisted in the CEF before him and had gone out and taken part in the fighting in 1915 and was killed. And one day, Wilbird was in a dugout when he was woken by this sensation of his brother standing in front of him, reaching out and taking him by the hand. He felt the warmth of his brother's hand leading him up the steps of the dugout now into this trench, just as a shell pitched out the night sky and went straight into the dugout and killed everybody inside. So that's kind of where that title comes from. And it's a magnificent book. It's a fantastic memoir of the Great War. And there's so much in it, in those key battles of 1917, covering that period of the war. He also wrote one of the really early kind of aftermath books of the Great War as well, called 13 Years After, which I remember coming across in the library of the Imperial War Museum many, many years ago in the 80s when I first went there, I think. And I can't remember whether it was Rose Coombs, but someone like that said, you should have a look at this. And it's Wilbird's account of visiting the battlefields 13 years after the armistice, going to those places where Canada had fought. They were articles that he'd written for a newspaper that were published in this single volume with illustrations that he'd taken. And I used that when I wrote my book on Courcelette, when I lived there, Canada's Great Battlefield from the Somme of 1916, because he describes a visit to that battlefield in the 1930s. But there I am on this trip earlier this year, standing there at Benny-sur-Mer Canadian War Cemetery, with row after row after row of headstones with maple leaves on, really showing Canada's sacrifice, not just in the Great War, which we think of when we go to places like the Menin Gate and see all those Canadian names, or the Vimy Memorial, or so many other places that were part of Canada's finest hours and some of their costliest hours in that conflict during the First World War. But it's the same here in Northwest Europe. Their importance of Canada's contribution in both World Wars can never ever be underestimated, particularly when you stand in a cemetery like this. But there I was looking at Stephen Bird's grave, and there he is, Stephen Bird. He's named after his uncle who was killed in the Great War. So two Stephen Birds in the database of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, connected by those two great events of the 20th century, one killed in the Great War, Will Bird's brother, and one killed in the battles for Caen, and buried here at Benny-sur-Mer, the son of Will Bird. And what must that have felt like, as a veteran of the Great War had given so much? And you sense from Will Bird's writing that there were aspects of the war that he was very bitter about. How must he have felt with the loss of his son in Normandy in 1944? I doubt whether he questioned the righteousness of the cause in defeating Nazi tyranny, but what a bitter blow for a man like him, for his generation, to see their sons go to war just a generation later, just a couple of decades later. And Wilbird threw himself into writing quite a lot of unit histories for World War II, and the one for his son's regiment and some of the others, they are fantastic pieces of work. And it kind of reminded me of how Kipling threw himself into writing the history of the Irish Guards to perhaps help with his loss. Maybe it was the same with Wilbird. Wilbird, though, was a survivor. He lost his brother, he lost his son, but he lived on to the 80s. And I only wish that I had known of him in the 80s and that I was in a position to go and see him, but that wasn't to be. We know him, though, through his books, through his writing. And 13 years after, Ghosts Have Warm Hands, I really can't recommend those enough. And it shows, I think, standing there in Béni-sur-Mer, how there's very few places that we can go to in our travels across the wider landscape of Europe, the wider landscape of two world wars, where we don't come across something that connects us to the Great War, connects us to those pathways, crisscross pathways, that seem to pull us back, pull us into that past, and the men and women of that past, again and again. And the connection between World War One and the overlap between World War One and World War Two was something that was very much on my mind when I was taking a group round the battlefields at Reims and Verdun recently, looking at the Chemin des Dames, the Aisne, the Champagne, the Argonne, and those incredible battlefields in the forest around the city of Verdun. The echoes of so many previous and wars after the Great War kind of ran through all of those places, from the Franco-Prussian War through to the Great War itself, through to events there in the two bookends of France's experience of the Second World War, 1940 and 1944. And as I took the group around those battlefields and we spoke about the American involvement and the American Meuse-Argonne offensive breaking out through those forests in the deep Argonne woodlands up towards the River Meuse, ending with the final battles of the last day of World War One on the 11th of November 1918, and Pershing's warning that if you don't defeat the Germans, if they don't see that they're defeated, if you don't round them up and there's a sense of defeat, they will rise again and return only too soon, and how prophetic his words were just by letting the Germans walk home in 1918 with the signing of the armistice. It created this myth that people like Hitler could exploit, that Germany had not been defeated, it had been stabs in the back. And there began, with so many other aspects besides, but there began a route to the next conflict. And I think that when you go to Verdun, as we did, and standing there, the ossuary, kind of, it's incredible. I don't know how many times I've been there, but when you get to Douaumont and you see the size of that ossuary building with the huge tower, like a massive artillery shell in the middle, and then look into those glass panels where the bones of tens of thousands of soldiers are piled high as that great warning to future generations, this is what conflict costs. And this building, created in that interwar period as a warning, as something that people must come and look at the horror of what war does to humanity. And then just a few years later, there were German soldiers, occupying forces, standing here on their own battlefield tours, looking at these sites, climbing onto the forts at Douaumont and Vaux, walking through the trenches. What had it all been for? That is something that on a recent tour to Paris, a Second World War tour, we were kind of asking, what must the generation of 1940, who saw defeat with the German occupation of France, what must that have made them feel about all those losses in the Great War? 1.4 million Frenchmen and men from their colonies who'd been killed in that conflict. What was it all for? And of course, coming up onto the Verdun battlefield, we passed and we stopped at the memorial to André Maginot. As a soldier in 1916, he was wounded and lost his leg. He became the Minister of War and was the man behind the famous Maginot Line, this system of defences that was built along the French border to protect France from a future invasion. Being there at Douaumont, standing on the roof of the forts at Douaumont itself, by the turrets, looking out across that forested landscape up towards the north, you're looking up towards where the Maginot Line is, the Ouvrage de Fermont, which is up there. I'm still on the roof of that, where there are very similar gun turrets that look like the ones at Fort Douaumont. And from there you can look back and you can easily see, even with the naked eye, you can see the tower of the ossuary amongst the forest at Verdun. Those two great conflicts, the echoes of Verdun leading to the construction of the Maginot Line, and then the whole defeat of France in that tragic year of war of 1940. It just runs through the whole story of these places. You can't see the war separate from World War II, and you can't see the Second World War without understanding the First. I don't think, really. And then, of course, you know, as you travel, you see echoes of this too. We drove down the Liberty Way, coming into Verdun, the route of the American liberation of this part of France in 1944, and that merges with the Voie Sacrée, the route of supply in 1916. So I think, you know, no wonder this is called the cockpit of Europe, all of this area where conflict has been fought over so many centuries. And I think that's also, for us as visitors, why I think it continues to give so much and fascinates us, because there is always something to learn. And I was reminded as we went up to the Mandat Massige, that fantastic area of reconstructed First World War trenches, where a group of experimental archaeologists and historians have created this First World War landscape with a really original looking trenches next to original mine craters using the original materials and sandbag materials and duck boards. And I mean, it's just incredible. It's one of those places I would say again and again, you must go to it. And we went there, and the group was just kind of overwhelmed by it. But as we drove away, we went past a demarcation stone from the post-war period, marking the limit of the German advance in 1918, one of many demarcation stones placed across the Great War landscape to do this. And this one, the top of it was shaved in half. It was missing completely. Where the French helmet should have been, there was nothing, because in May 1940, on this dead straight road that we were on, German panzers had come down there during the Blitzkrieg, and a tank shell had taken the top of that demarcation stone off. So another one of those focus points where the Great War met the Second World War. But my mind, as always, I mean, we ended this season on the Somme, walking from Contalmaison to Bazentin. My mind always wanders back to the Somme battlefields. Very much at the heart of my own love of the Great War landscape, a place where I lived and had visited for so many years and still feel so greatly connected to it. And this year, a few times, I've been lucky to walk up onto Hawthorne Ridge and walk not just to the small cemetery there at Hawthorne No. 1, but through the mine crater and see the work that the Hawthorne Crater Association are doing there to open that up and enhance our understanding of that part of the Somme battlefields. But to get up onto the crest of that ridge to that little cemetery and look out to see the cemeteries that kind of litter that landscape, not by accident, they're all there for a reason. They mark the spots where those crisscross paths meant, where the fighting was at its heaviest. And you can see the Red Ann Ridge cemeteries, and up towards Serre, you can see across the sunken lane, you can see that rolling texture of the Somme. It's a place that I never, ever tire of being up there. And above you is the skylark, and around you in that cemetery are the rows of the graves of men who fell there at the two bookends of the Battle of the Somme, the 1st of July and the 13th of November, the first day in that glorious summer sunshine, and the Battle of the Ancre, when a different kind of battle was fought here to the battle that had begun this great offensive on the Somme. And there, of course, for me, always special is that grave with Eric Rupert Heaton's name on, the little plaque laid by his family and his sister, who I knew. I've told that story so many times here. But this, to me, is what all of these visits are about. This is what draws us back. It's the stories of those ordinary men and women in those extraordinary circumstances of the Great War. The human stories, the cost of war, what the landscape means, what it tells us about the wider history. And that all leads into the other, often more academic aspects of the Great War, with tactics and the development of equipment and weaponry and the use of men on the ground and how their war experience changed from 1914 through to the end of the conflict in 1918. But that's that draw of landscape, draw of place, and our desire to look and to learn and understand. And we find all of that every time we take those pathways of the Great War, there in the quiet lanes and amongst the dark trees and in the open, vast open fields. We're back in the very heart of the Great War back along the old front line. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCor. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.